When we speak of the correct principles of human association, we mean those principles which, when applied, will afford the greatest degree of human satisfaction. We are particularly concerned about such essential areas as security, freedom, and the self-development and dignity of the individual. We are concerned that all people have the opportunity to express themselves in an environment of love and service. It has been said that the correct principles of human association are as capable of exact definition as are those of engineering and the precise sciences, and that departure from them is equally catastrophic. This is certainly true in large measure. Many great religious and political leaders dedicated themselves to the definition and application of correct principles of human association in society. The limiting factor in their application would seem to be a refusal to believe and accept these clearly correct principles. A good example is the so-called golden rule of human association, which says, "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you." Disbelief in their effectiveness, rather than ignorance of their existence, seems to be the greatest problem. The concept of a correct principle or axiom is supportive of the idea of universal truth for all situations. The principle, for instance, that honesty is the best policy is regarded as being true for all men at all times. We are, nevertheless, all familiar with situations in which we have accepted second best. The principle that honesty is the best policy remains firm, even when things aren't the best and we depart from it. In this segment, we shall attempt to apply some of the things we have learned from freedom potentials to areas of life which have not yet been examined. The scope of this school is such that an exhaustive application of principles may not be attempted. However, by way of an example, we shall address the issue of education. We ask, who should be responsible in education? Who should have the last say? Who should have control of this vitally important area of social activity? How would the education of children work in a truly free and responsible community? We shall also be considering applications in local government. It may well be that the specific areas chosen for discussion are not those best suited to summon forth your interest. Your passion might be for the achievement of freedom through dry constitutional legalism or some other discipline. People motivated by freedom and excited by the prospect of achieving freedom potentials have always gravitated into particular areas of life in which they feel themselves most competent to serve, or which they believe are the most important. They usually determine to gain competency to serve in those areas. The variety that this implies is a source of great strengths in the movement towards freedom potential. The subject of the education of children is complicated by the fact that young children are obviously not competent with responsible freedom. All recognise that a child's growth towards emancipation is a matter of time and experience. Who, then, is responsible for the education of children? There are only three contending parties. One is that the parents are responsible, and this is the one we accept in this course. Some consider that the state is responsible. This is rejected on several grounds. Among them is the consideration that such an enormous centralisation of power in the hands of those who direct the state would create an enormous impetus towards establishing tyranny. The Christian spirit of the West has highlighted the importance of the family and defined responsibilities within the family. There are other important considerations. The state is only an abstraction. It is simply a symbol for persons who are more remote from individual children than parents. Parents are those people who are most likely to love them and to understand their uniqueness. They are most likely to know their special interests and needs regarding self-development. Another important reason for rejecting the state as the ultimate authority in education is that governments are not prepared to accept or even to answer and quite correctly so, the really important questions about education. If a government in a democratic nation is asked to define education as opposed to schooling, they normally give the definition that it has to do with preparing individuals for life. When pressed as to the meaning of being human or the meaning of and purpose of life, the state is hopelessly incompetent and unprepared to give any answers. Can you imagine the principal of your old school answering your question, "Sir, would you please tell me precisely the meaning of life, the universe and everything?" Clearly, the state would be trying to cope with something that can only be defined in terms of spiritual and moral values. However, the state, by common acceptance in free societies, has the function of protecting individuals from the deprivations of others. If it can be shown under common law procedures that a parent is guilty by omission of depriving a child of essential basic literacy, the state's right to act is accepted. The parent's responsibility is primary and the state's secondary. It is occasionally maintained that educators or teachers are responsible for the education of children. Of course they are to a point, but this is very definitely a delegated and administrative responsibility. How then might we reconcile these different, although not conflicting, responsibilities? How then can the primary responsibility of parents, the secondary responsibility of the state, and the delegated responsibility of teachers be correctly related so that children are properly educated? The answer can only come by returning to the consideration of sanctions. When citizens have had effective sanctions, they have developed an abstraction called a political vote. Every adult who was granted a political vote could use it to help direct the political life of the nation. We will discuss the prospect of conferring the financial vote upon the citizen also. This involves distributing the ownership of all new money creations to go directly to individual citizens on the basis that each would have one share in the whole. In the meantime, we shall consider the prospects of an educational vote. For some years, there has been increasing discussion and interest, and even a little experimentation at the county level in the United States, in something called the voucher system of education. In this system, the state might be constitutionally bound to accept the primary responsibility of the parent for education, without denying its own secondary responsibility to ensure that the standards are adequate. Under the voucher system, the state decides what community finance shall be allocated to education, as is now the case. However, instead of the state setting up state schools or a subsidy system for non-state schools, funds for education would be dispersed directly to the parents through the voucher system. If there were, in a particular county, say 1,000 children to be educated, and the allocation for education per annum was $1 million, then each child would have $1,000 per annum spent on his or her education. Under this voucher system, education vouchers valued at $1,000 would then be issued to parents for each child of school-going age. These vouchers could not be used to acquire anything other than education. The education vouchers would be tendered by parents to a school of their choice in order to pay for their children's education. The government would pay to any school or faculty which met the minimum standard the sum of $1,000 for every voucher surrendered. In this way, the primary responsibility of the parent is upheld. Parents may have the school of their choice and the type of schooling which they believe will best suit their children's development. Parents can shift the tax-paid share of the education of their child from one school to another, thereby growing one school and possibly eliminating another. The government, however, can ensure that its basic responsibility is upheld by imposing some testing mechanisms on schooling faculties. Teachers who might prefer to expand their professional role in offering something innovative might anticipate a freer hand in doing so. There is, after all, a greater diversity of parental preferences than there are governments. Options might include using phonics to teach literacy instead of look-say methods. They might prefer traditional disciplines such as history and geography rather than the more loosely defined social studies. Parents may opt for a particular kind of moral content whilst complying with the state's insistence upon basic skills. These would certainly open the range of choice to parents. It would also, no doubt, expand the options to a point where many parents and teachers would be appalled. Nevertheless, parents in the voucher system are granted the right to remove their child and to take the allocated tax monies to some more preferable school. The range of schools in many localities will be limited by various factors. In some more remote areas, the option may be either to remove the child from school into one of the correspondence courses, or to approach one's neighbours with a view to establishing, if possible, an independent school. At present, the old adage that he who pays the piper calls the tune does not quite describe the situation in education. Certainly, the taxpayer does pay the piper, but since he does so compulsorily through an intermediary called the government, it is that government which acquires the sanctions to determine what type of education is going to be given to the children. Under the voucher system, parents do pay the piper. Everyone would continue to contribute compulsorily through taxation to an education fund, but the parents would draw upon that fund to the extent of the number of children they have to educate. If the state, as it continues to offer state education services, finds that it is unable to cope with the revenue from vouchers, it would be restricted to increasing the value of the vouchers. The allocation of tax to that purpose would fund all other schools to this level also. Those parents who believe that the value of the voucher to be inadequate would have the option to add their own funds to the voucher at the school of their choice. This system would greatly simplify the government's involvement and responsibility. A simple register might be maintained where parents could register their children for the purpose of gaining education vouchers. These vouchers would then be issued on a regular basis. Apart from paying schools monthly for vouchers presented to the government, the only staff necessary under direct government supervision would be those required to establish minimum standards and a system of inspection to ensure that they were met. The voucher system is simply another freedom potential. Under this system, all parents would have an effective say because they control the flow of dollars to the schools of their choice. While no doubt many could point to prospective problems and shortcomings, freedom is not always the most ordered and comfortable option, but it gives the greatest security from tyranny and other abuses. The case against the voucher system is almost entirely composed of those objections to freedom which are most readily heard from politicians. They say that parents don't know what sort of education is best for their children. In a technical and professional sense, that may well be true. Nevertheless, parents are the ultimate authorities regarding the required results. They are likely to be the most motivated and to ensure that a particular system is in the best interests of their children. In the end, it probably comes down to something that parents must decide for themselves. The freedom of parents to make decisions regarding their children's education is of far greater concern than the possibility that some parents may err in some or other of these decisions. We must be prepared to grant freedom to others if we want to enjoy it ourselves. There would be a transitional period where the school system would continue to operate for some time, almost as it does now. The education voucher system operates primarily as a voter's veto, or if you like, a parent's veto on education. At any one time, it would be used by only a small minority of disaffected parents, but would reflect larger trends over a lengthy period of time. where parents of like mind live close together, they could organise and form their own school. It may well be that many parents would show themselves to be ill-informed. On the other hand, those parents, together with the teachers, may make real advances that would be valued by other educational groups. Freedom alone can offer this creative possibility. Education is a freedom issue. Certainly there are dangers. However, these dangers are not foisted upon parents who are almost helpless, unless, of course, they are relatively rich. Education vouchers are, in the end, only a freedom potential. If parents do not wish to have that freedom to make the really big decisions about the type of education their children shall receive, then such a freedom shall never be used. Those who approach education vouchers by considering all of the mistakes that might be made will no doubt find themselves considering smaller and smaller points at a greater and greater distance from the central question. The key question for every parent is whether they will take the responsibility for education themselves, that is, whether they want the freedom to make educational policy decisions. If we want that freedom for ourselves, then we must remind ourselves again of the very first segments, that freedom is a macro product. You can only have that freedom for yourself if and when it is held in common by all parents. When a majority feel themselves compelled to support the introduction of education vouchers, then given that citizens-initiated referendums have been established, this freedom will also be added to them. Occasionally, objections to a voucher system of education are raised at a more mechanical level. For instance, some years ago, in discussion with a backbench member of Parliament, who later became for a time a Minister for Education, the voucher system was suggested. This backbencher said that he believed it couldn't possibly work because of all of the good schools would find themselves hopelessly over-enrolled. What good school would allow over-enrolment so that children had no choice but to stand in the aisles or be crammed into classrooms, thus reducing standards? This would subsequently prejudice the parents' support, now so vital in a voucher education system. Apparently, it had never occurred to this backbencher, later Minister for Education, that all of the more popular schools and the greater public schools set strict upper limits to their enrolments. If parents could take funding with them to alternative schools, two things would happen. One would be that facilities would tend to grow in those schools that parents most approved of. Some additional schools of this nature would come into being. But perhaps more significantly than this would be the changes that would take place in other schools. They would be forced to emulate those giving the most satisfactory results in order to maintain attendances and therefore to maintain the school itself. Just as the possession of money expands economic freedom and enfranchises people to make economic choices, so too could the voucher system expand educational freedom, irrespective of the wealth of parents. There would occur both an expansion of the range of choice open to parents and also a great preparedness by administrators to listen and respond to parents. The real answer to the scarcity of good education is not to ration scarcity through limited enrolments, but to expand the availability of good education through more interested and efficient input from parents. Quality might not be a matter of money so much as competence and sensitivity in the teaching profession, sponsored by parents who take up their responsibility with increased interest in their children's education. Democracy is not simply a matter of the people choosing the government with their vote, nor is it wholly a case of the people making the decisions. These things are indispensable to freedom, but there is more. Each decision must be made as closely as possible to the people it affects. Democracy involves the decentralisation of power. A democratically elected world government, which allowed 1% of citizens to initiate referendums, might be nothing short of tyranny. Imagine that the road in front of your home had several enormous crater-like potholes. You want them fixed. You write to the roads department in Timbuktu. They ignore you. You find it difficult to get 100 million people to take an interest in your potholes and sign a petition for a world referendum. World government is unlikely to fall from power on the red-hot issue of your potholes. The local representative of the world government may fix your road, and then again they might not. If they don't, what do you do? What can you do? Thus, the centralisation of power is tyrannous, no matter what the good intentions or benevolence at some remote point. The basis of democracy is the decentralisation of power. The selection of representatives is decentralised to voters. Policy decisions are decentralised to the people, but just as importantly, government itself is broke to bring the decision-making as close to the individual as is possible. Where a decision is one of only local or regional effect, it ought to be made at that level. Where a decision can be properly made at a lower level, then the decentralisation of the power to make that decision enhances freedom. As we have seen earlier, local government was a major factor in the development of order in Britain. It was only later that the strength of more central governments began to develop. This was also true in the United States, Australia, and elsewhere. Long before any central government existed, there was a collection of states with limited powers, but most decisions about how ordinary people were to live were made on a local basis. It is natural that wherever a small community or a village exists, local people should get together frequently to decide upon their own development. They would deal with issues like where the roads should go, how the schools should operate, local entertainment and sport, and essential services like hospitals and medical care. When local people are fully involved in decisions, they tend to act with great responsibility and understanding of the issues that are involved. In Switzerland, things still develop from the ground up. The country is divided into a number of cantons, which are local communities. They even decide on such matters as defence and immigration and other matters that have a large effect on the nature of the community as a whole. In Switzerland, it is the local community that raises taxes. A portion of those taxes is then paid to the central government. One can see immediately that the ordinary individual would have much greater control of how much tax he would pay and how it was to be spent. In fact, this was also the case in the early period of English history. In many countries, this process has now been reversed. The central government collects taxes, and the people have little say on how it is spent or how much should be gathered. The result is tyrannous taxation, and its misuse in all sorts of benighted causes, including gay Mardi Gras, politicians' perks, empire building and political propaganda campaigns. There are many such things that annoy the people and over which the people have no control. In the early period of Australia's history, local government acts, which were created by the states, paid heed to the right of the people to have some sanction over their council. Thus, in the Australian state of New South Wales, the Local Government Act provided the right of the people to have a poll on money raised by the council if they felt it was excessive. Ratepayers had the right to pay rates in service rather than in cash. The ratepayer could turn up at the local council and demand from the shire engineer or the town clerk some sort of work, which he then carried out until his rates had been paid. In order to prevent large numbers of people from doing this, the council was concerned to keep its rates as low as possible. That has now been reversed in many cases, so that councillors feel no responsibility to seek the agreement of the people in raising rates or in how the funds should be spent. In fact, even local governments themselves make fewer and fewer decisions. because they are controlled increasingly by central governments. In early British history, the sanctions belonged to the people. The people had the strength. Not only did you have the right to work your taxes off, but you had the right to pay in kind rather than in cash. Thus, you could turn up and pay your taxes with a fat goose, or a bag of potatoes, or a barrel of wine, or something that you had produced. This has often led to speculation that if we could reintroduce such a provision, the pig farmers, for example, might descend on the tax department and demand the right to pay their taxes with pigs. One of the great tasks is to regain a greater ratepayer participation in local councils and to reintroduce the belief that councillors, just as the politicians, are simply the servants of the people with whom they should consult regularly. With this in mind, an interesting exercise took place in one part of Australia a few years ago. A local council raised the rates by 40%, a figure that was going to hurt many people. The result was a mass meeting of some 400 ratepayers in the local hall, all breathing fire and brimstone. They had no plan of action, but they certainly had an opportunity to vent their anger. There were demands that the council be sacked, and the shire engineer flogged or tarred and feathered, and a number of other fairly irresponsible measures. When it was all over, nothing had changed, except that six people out of the original 400 agreed to form a watchdog ratepayers association. They had no money, but they met regularly and collected enough money to have a nice letterhead printed called the District Ratepayers Association. They waited patiently until the council elections came up and decided not only to challenge their own council, but to take on a number of other councils in the surrounding districts. They identified all the candidates, and each candidate for five different councils received a letter from this body which asked them a number of simple questions. Firstly, would they agree that they should not increase the taxes without asking the people first, since the people had to pay? Secondly, would they resist all pressures to amalgamate the councils together, which was an issue at that time? Amalgamation would make local government more remote from the people. Besides, the councils did not belong to the councillors, but to the people. Thirdly, would they meet with their ratepayers regularly and find out what they wanted and how they wanted their money to be spent? Each candidate was then notified that his answers would be placed in the local newspaper. This produced wild indignation. Many old councillors who had been on their councils for many years wrote back saying that they didn't like being thus questioned. One wrote saying that his job was not to represent the people, it was to run the council. Another replied saying that he had been on the council for 20 years and had never answered questions before and wouldn't start now. Other replies in similar vein were given. Some of the new candidates, wanting to get onto the council, replied in a more civil fashion, saying they believed they should consult the people. But the majority did not bother to reply at all. The small group of six people in the local ratepayers association drew all this up into a sample advertisement. At the top of the advertisement, they listed the questions that had been asked. Down the left-hand side, they placed the name of each candidate standing for council, old and new, and next to each one, they simply put what the reply had been. The first said he did not like being asked questions. The second said he had never answered questions before and was not going to start now. The third said that his job was not to represent the people but to run the council, and so on. Those who had answered more civilly also had their replies recorded word for word. At the bottom was the biggest section, those who had not had the courtesy to reply to the ratepayers, even though they were wanting to stand for council. This sample advertisement was taken through the local district and down the main street, and people were asked to contribute to its publication in the local newspaper. Because it hit the nail on the head, the money was subscribed in a few hours, and the advertisement duly appeared, a full page. The people were asked to refer to it when they went to cast their votes for the council. No suggestion was made as to how people should vote. It was simply information provided for the voters' use. But the people, given something to vote on, voted with a great change. Those who had shown irresponsibility were voted off the council. New councils were elected, and for a short while they did act with responsibility. Councils went back to their areas and asked their ratepayers about how much money should be raised and how it should be spent. They even put the council budget on a blackboard and discussed this and other issues in public meetings. Two things happened as a result of that particular campaign. The people themselves, feeling that they were now part of the process, increased their interest in council matters, and voting subsequently went up considerably. Secondly, councillors themselves improved their performance and genuinely felt that they were representatives of the people, that they had a mandate to serve, and that they were to simply carry out what the people wanted. Thus, a much greater degree of responsibility developed. The rudiments of this campaign can be applied in many situations. Basically, it comes back to the principle that you cannot have good government unless it is responsible to the people. You cannot have good government unless the people themselves take the initiative. When there are sufficient numbers of people who wish to regain responsible, service-motivated institutions, that is, representative government, then we do get a change for the better.